Welcome to Switchblade Sisters, where women get together to slice and dice our favorite action and genre films. I'm film critic April Wolf. Every week I invite a new female filmmaker on, a writer, director, actor, producer, and we talk in depth about one of their fave genre films, perhaps one that influenced their own work in some strange way. Today I'm real excited to have actor, writer, director, producer Amy Seibetz here with me. Hi.
Hi.
So for those of you who are less familiar with Amy's work, please let me give her an introduction here. Amy was born in Florida and attended FSU before moving to Los Angeles to build her career in Hollywood. She started out writing, directing, and acting in short films and made her feature debut in a pair of films, Black Dragon Canyon and the indie cult hit Wrist Cutters, A Love Story. Then she was associate producer on Barry Jenkins' debut feature, Medicine for Melancholy, and appeared in films such as Gabby on the Roof in July, Tiny Furniture, You're Next, and The Myth of the American Sleepover before directing her own feature debut, Sun Don't Shine, in 2012. The film tells the story of a couple who embark on a strange, intense road trip through Central Florida. It won special jury prize at South by Southwest and was nominated for 2 Gotham Awards. Amy then went on to co-create and executive produce the critically acclaimed Starz series, The Girlfriend Experience. Based on the Steven Soderbergh feature of the same name, the show premiered in 2015 and was nominated for a Golden Globe and quickly renewed for a second season, which aired in 2017. In 2018, Amy directed 2 episodes of the acclaimed FX series Atlanta and subsequently signed a First Look Television production development deal with the network. But yes, she continued acting throughout the time as well. And you've seen her in Upstream Color, Alien Covenant, The Killing, Stranger Things, Lean on Pete, etc., etc., etc. Right now, Amy's in a trio of films, My Days of Mercy, which I believe is out on VOD right now, I think. Is that available?
It's coming out in May.
Okay. So it's coming out in May on VOD, and Wild Nights with Emily and Pet Cemetery are out in theaters, I think, now.
Currently.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So there's a lot of ways that you can see Amy and her work.
Yeah.
The film that she chose to talk about today really surprised me because, well, Amy, could you tell us why you chose The Peanut Butter Solution as your fave genre film?
Ooh. Well, I saw it when I think I must have been at an age where you can't, like, place it. It was on PBS.
Yeah.
I must have been 4 or 5.
Yeah.
And it was one of those films that just come on and you just accept that it's on the television. And I remember watching it and being terrified of it and finding it extremely disturbing.
Mm-hmm.
And then as I got older, I would, with other artists, I would try to tell them or ask them if they saw The Peanut Butter Solution, and it's very rare that somebody has.
Yeah.
That's the other thing. When you try to explain the plot, there's a lot of people that think that you're making it up. So there came a point where I thought I had just made this movie up,
mm-hmm.
like in childlike logic. And then I think the first person that I talked to that had actually seen it was Ty West. And there was like a deep, dark, like stare back at me in like a scarred way that he too had seen this movie and that it disturbed him deeply.
I'm sure it affects all of his films too.
Yeah.
The Innkeepers, definitely.
Definitely. Yeah. And I think, and I've met most of the people that I've met that have seen it or were disturbed by it when they're younger happen to be genre filmmakers.
Yeah, I absolutely believe that. I thought for a long time when I was a kid, I saw it, and I thought it was somehow in that movie, Little Monsters with Howie Mandel, which also scared the shit out of me. So I mixed those two up, and I was just like, oh, there's no peanut butter in the Little Monsters? And then I was just like, oh, maybe I made that part up.
But then
it was a separate fucking movie.
There's another one. I forget where it is. I must have combined that movie because the plot's so crazy that it seems like you've combined movies anyways.
Yes.
There's another movie that when I was rewatching it, I was like, do they then put themselves on a stamp and then fly themselves around the world? And then I realized that was another movie and I forget which one that was, but it might as well be. Like the plot might as well just keep going.
Yeah, the 80s were a great time.
Yeah.
For those of you who haven't seen The Peanut Butter Solution, and this is going to be funny, today's episode will give you some spoilers, but that shouldn't stop you from listening before you watch. My motto, as always, it's not what happens, but how it happens that makes a movie worth watching. Still, if you would like to pause and watch The Peanut Butter Solution first, there's no way we can spoil this for you. Go ahead.
You should probably do it now.
Now let's introduce The Peanut Butter Solution with a concise synopsis. Okay. Written by Wojtek Jasny, Andre Pelletier, Louise Pelletier, and Michael Rabeau, and directed by Rabeau. The Peanut Butter Solution stars young Matthew McKay as Michael, an 11-year-old boy whose mother is attending to the estate of her dead father in Australia and whose painter father is caring for him. Okay, so mother's gone, dad's there, that's where we enter. Michael hears about a mansion that's burned down, and his friend Connie dares him to look inside.
Are you gonna try it? I said, are you gonna try it? No, I'm gonna do it.
He sees some scary ghosts and tumbles out of the house, but we don't really know what he sees. And the next day, he's lost all his hair from, quote-unquote, the fright. His father and sister, Susie, force a wig onto him, and he goes to school, but a bully immediately rips it off in slow motion. And Michael's humiliated. Then Michael has a kind of dream where a now-dead homeless couple he met once show up and give him a recipe for a concoction that will make his hair grow back, because they are trying to pay back the kindness that he had for giving them some money earlier in a flashback scene that comes out of nowhere.
A fistful of kitty litter.
A fistful of kitty litter.
Three Connie Crisps.
Three Connie Crisps.
Three Crosby Crackers.
Three Crosby Crackers.
Nine spoons of soil.
Nine spoons of soil.
And a glass of Fibber's Fizz.
What's Fibber's Fizz? Oh,
it's mouthwater. The biggest mouthwater in the world.
Put it all on my head.
We gotta go, Mary.
Yeah. Now, last thing is a spoonful of peanut butter, and that's very important because it makes it all stick together. But don't use too much of it or watch out.
What'll happen?
Well, it ain't for me to say. You just watch out, huh?
But when he finally makes it after one thwarted attempt, it's too thin and runs, so he thickens it with more peanut butter. The next morning, he's already sprouting hair. Connie's curious and decides to spread the concoction on his nether regions.
Let me try it.
Why? You don't need it. You got lots of hair.
Sure, but...
But what?
Put some down there.
Are you crazy?
No, get out of here and let a guy do what he's got to do.
Unfortunately, both boys discover that the hair will not stop growing no matter what they do. Michael's hair is growing so fast that Connie has to constantly groom it while they're in school. Connie's pubic hair is dragging out of his pant legs, and it's a disaster. The school kicks out Michael for being a distraction. Oh, and did I mention that there's an art teacher named the Senor who forces the children to paint pictures of his dog and refuses to allow creativity in his class?
You dare to imagine in my class? I've told you 1,000 times, no imagination. Only what you see. I want accuracy.
Okay, well, meanwhile, he's found out to be a fraud and let go. Michael runs away from home and doesn't come back, but Connie and Susie are determined to find him. They go to an art store and purchase a paintbrush, and Susie is absolutely sure that the brush is actually made with Michael's beautiful hair.
Connie, feel his hair. So? It's hair. Bristles, hairs, what's the difference?
I know this hair. I've cut this hair.
You don't? Are you certain?
We're holding a bit of Michael in our hand.
They find out the Senor has been selling the brushes to the store, and they track him down to a lair where he has kidnapped a bunch of children and put them to work cutting Michael's hair and making it into paintbrushes to sell. It's basically a sweatshop. Connie comes in and pretends he wants the Senor to be his father, which turns the Senor into a nice guy for some reason, and then Connie tricks him into painting the mansion.
My son will give me a subject, and in 1 minute or less, it will appear on the biggest canvas. I am ready, my son.
Could you possibly do Michael's fight, Dad?
Michael's fight? What is that?
The thing that made his hair fall. The burnout building. The fright.
The Comtal building? The Comtal building, that's all? That's so easy.
Everything the paintbrushes paint comes to life, by the way. And then Connie tricks the Senor into going into this mansion that was brought to life by the Senor's paint to see what's inside. The senor goes inside. He gets the fright, tumbles out of the mansion, and then that successfully passes the fright from Michael to the senor. The senor is arrested, and Michael is reunited with his family. Are you guys following? I feel like that was an hour long. It's longer than the movie.
You can't, for my own sanity, you don't know how good it is to hear it out loud, to know that it actually happened. Because watching it as a kid, there's so many moments that I went in rewatching it where it's not just that it's so surreal and like an exquisite corpse in its own yes. surrealist way.
Yeah.
But it's also, there's these really bizarre moments, like when the ghosts come and tell them the peanut butter solution.
Yeah.
After it's all done and she's given the recipe, she says this really creepy thing where she says,
"That's life, sweetheart. You don't get no second chance."
And then she goes on and she's like, "Sometimes I'm good, sometimes I'm bad. Today I'm bad." And you're like, "What is going on?" It's just so creepy and like disjointed. And for like, I was describing it to a friend of mine recently and suggested they watch it. And I was like, as a kid, you know, even if you're scared of something, in narrative, there's a logical like movement to it. So
yeah.
The same way that if you're with a parent or an adult that you trust, you know, you sort of like trust that this is going to happen and you go along with whatever.
Yes.
The peanut butter solution is like being with an adult on acid or like drugs where you're like, I don't know what's happening. Yeah. I just know something's wrong.
Yeah. I don't know if I can trust you, but I feel like I have to because you're the only thing there for me guiding me through this experience.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, but it defies rules, so you're sort of like, I don't know if I can trust this movie, and it just scarred me.
Yes, but it's something to think about, and I think it's something that we'll kind of weave in and out of this, you know, entire conversation is it's breaking every rule that mm-hmm. you're supposed to have for narrative storytelling, and yet it is one of the most memorable children's films that was ever made, and what does that mean? You know, is it saying that it's okay to break the rules? When is it okay to break the rules? Like, what does it tell us about narrative filmmaking?
I mean, I don't quite know. I mean, I don't even know. I guess this is loosely narrative. I do notice that, like, the interesting thing that I was listening to some of the dialogue, including that section with the ghost lady.
Yeah.
And I was like, this feels like pages when I'm free writing for an idea.
Mm-hmm.
This feels like pages that I'm not sure if this idea is going to lead anywhere,
mm-hmm.
but I need to write these ideas down in order to get to this other thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I usually end up cutting them. But like a lot of the pages in this feel like they, like a free write, like a stream of conscious free write.
Yeah.
And the pages that you usually cut out of your script to, like, actually have a narrative,
yeah.
you know?
Like that you, and it's an interesting thing that this has four writers.
Yeah.
And Wojtek, and, you know, he was a celebrated Czechoslovakian filmmaker.
Yes, but a surrealist filmmaker.
It's surrealist, exactly, yeah. That's something that I think we should say, Rock Demers is the guy who created this entire series, because this movie is one in so many series. I think the series is still going on, or it just ended or something like that. But there's so many movies within this for children. And so this is one of the first few that he had produced for Tales for All, is the name of it, out of, I think, Montreal.
Yes.
And he was really into surrealist children's films. Like it was his thing. I think he said that he was traveling through Prague or something, and he had maybe met Wojtek or something, or a different filmmaker who was making a children's film. And he was shown a children's film that had only, you know, like a quote-unquote, like, poeticism to it. And it was just visual poetry, and it was something that he had never seen before, but it was something that really, really attracted children. And he understood that there was something about, like, the dreamlike logic of that really attracted kids.
Yeah.
And the adults didn't quite understand, but surrealists got.
Right. And that, I mean, this is another, the other part of this story that I find really interesting on like a producing level of filmmaking
yeah.
is that I know that the Canadian board was like specifically wanted children's films.
Yeah.
And so they were like, we'll give you money, but it has to be a children's film.
Yeah.
So I think they were like, okay. Like, we'll make this crazy film and it'll be for kids, sure.
Yeah. 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 Because you had, like, there was also, like, the kind of Canucksploitation movement that was happening where, like, horror filmmakers were like, oh, you're giving out money?
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay, we'll I'll take it. Yeah. Sure, sure, sure. That's fine. That's
yeah.
fine.
Whatever. Yeah, we'll exactly.
Make it. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm, you know, I'm glad that they took advantage of it. But it's a film that was on HBO and PBS in the U.S. And Roch Demers had created it specifically to be an export, as opposed to just being in Canada, which I thought was really interesting. Where he was very financially minded, and he realized that with children's films that they actually translate really well internationally, especially if they have this kind of dreamlike nature to them.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if that stamp movie that I was part of that, too.
I wonder.
I should look it up. Yeah.
Oh, actually, our producer is nodding.
It is. Okay. Because they're very similar. And there must be some co-production with Australia because
Channel 4 or what do they
maybe.
Have done
there? Well, I'm not sure, but I think because in the movie, his wife is in Australia and then in the stamp movie, I remember there's a lot. They send the letters to Australia.
Oh, yeah.
And they go end up in Australia.
Yeah, I would definitely. Yeah, yeah. I would bet that that was it.
Yeah.
And actually, a lot of people around that time were kind of angry at Roch Demers for making movies that weren't specifically for Canada or weren't set in Canada. And so this is like a big kind of criticism that was happening around this movie at the time, which is it's strange to think about.
Funny.
But the criticism for The Peanut Butter Solution was it was the first film in the series that was designed to look like it could have been anywhere. That it wasn't, it didn't have any kind of Canadian landmarks. It didn't have any specifically Canadian things. It kind of wiped out the accent of Canada. You know, it didn't have any kind of like French speaking people anywhere.
Right.
So people were like, oh, why are we making these movies in Canada if we're not going to put our stamp on them? And I'm curious what you think about, you know, the idea of having movies that really specifically belong in a place. I know that your feature debut, I mean, like, that's Central Florida. And that's obviously influenced by where you're from and how you grew up.
Yeah, obviously. I use landscape as atmosphere another character in there. And it's very important that the where we shoot and taking that in consideration. I don't necessarily know if it's because I know like in like Quebec too, it's like a lot of the like Xavier Dolan and they make very they make films that are so specific to Quebec.
Yeah.
Maybe not. I mean his are transcend that, but you know that's like part of the deal is that it has to be culturally part of their culture, but for me, where I shoot becomes another character in it, and it just adds to the atmosphere, and it adds to the tension, and it adds to the consequences. I guess like in Sun Don't Shine, the heat element, and in my opinion, it's one of the factors that makes everything just unsavory. The sweat and the humidity, and it also I think the heat and the humidity make you crazy, and you're watching these two people go crazy, and it was just so important to show that, and also the fact that a lot of Central Florida is, you know, hidden behind all of this vegetation, so it's so easy to imagine, or at least this is what I do, but imagine where there's tons of bodies hidden in these.
Like, I like that you're like, yes, this is what I think the second time I look at like thick vegetation, there's like clearly bodies hidden here.
Yeah, I mean, growing up in the, I mean, and that was even growing up in Florida too. You know, I would think, I mean, there's constantly kidnappings and there's crazy stories. And so when I was growing up there, I did think about that, like think about just very from a very young age, those dark elements of like the mangroves and thinking there's probably bodies back there.
Mm-hmm.
And like, and having like a dark fascination or attraction to, like, say, going in the house in The Peanut Butter Solution and wanting to see a dead body, but not really wanting to see a dead body, but wanting to see, or like Stand By Me, or is that sort of obsession with maybe I want to see a dead body, maybe I don't, you don't really, but you have, like, kids, I think,
yeah,
have a fascination with that.
They're just, it's just curiosity. Like, you, there's something out in the world and you would like to know what it is.
Yeah, because nobody's talking about it, too.
Yeah, yeah. That the kind of hush-hush about certain things makes you maybe more fascinated, you know?
Yeah.
It's probably, it's like why I love horror movies. And like, oh, no one talks about it. I'm like, well, murder. I'm very interested
yeah.
in this.
Yeah, we all die. Yeah.
yeah. So weird.
Yeah. Isn't it weird? We all die, but we don't talk about it. But, yeah, so... Yeah, so but I do find it, I as soon as I heard that that was part of the bargain with Peanut Butter Solution where Canada was giving away money for a kid's movie, I was yeah. like, could I make a kid's movie like this? I'm sure it'll be just as fucked up as this one, but,
yeah,
you know, it's very tempting.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about the kind of origins of how Michael Robo came up with this idea and get a little bit further into the production and some messages about mixed messages about fear and morals.
Exactly.
Okay, we'll be right back.
The Greatest Generation is a Star Trek podcast that destigmatizes the very idea of having a Star Trek podcast.
We're Ben and Adam, the hosts of The Greatest Generation, and the technology we've developed is that nobody knows what you're playing in your earbuds.
You know, with legalization, it's easier than ever to find out what's in your buds. But we suggest that you legally find The Greatest Generation wherever you download your podcasts.
We'll send it to you in a discreet, unmarked package, and nobody has to know but us.
That's The Greatest Generation, the Star Trek podcast that you didn't know you needed, yet makes you feel like you belong.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm here joined today by Amy Simetz, and we're talking about The Peanut Butter Solution. We've got a quick update from producer Casey. What's the Tommy Tricker and
the stamp? Traveler.
And the Tommy Tricker and the Stamp Traveler is another film that is actually also directed by Michael Robo. And Michael Robo is Australian. And so everything ties together where you just are a super fan of Michael Robo.
That just turns out I just all of his movies and I got them. You're Isn't like, that so gratifying? You're like, I think something has to do with Australia.
Yes.
He would be so, I would be so happy if, as a filmmaker, if somebody picked up on that and like, oh, then it is the same person.
Yes. So I feel like we should get into Robo's life and work. He is a painter. He was a painter. He is a painter. I think he exclusively paints right now. He's got a book of his paintings and he travels around with it and he gives lectures on painting. So you can see a kind of piece of himself in this where he was very interested in painting. And specifically, you've got the senor who won't let anyone paint anything that has any creativity. And in that was his way of kind of telling children that you should see the world how you see it, not as an adult will
right.
force you to see it.
Yeah,
that's the one mainstream or like thought that feels like I can connect
cohesive,
it. It's
yeah.
cohesive, yes. But he said that the reason that he came up with the story is, you know, apparently, quote unquote, accidental. He said, my son Nicholas was 6 years old. I wrote him a little story called Michael's Fright about a character who loses all his hair. And I showed it to a producer. And he said, would you like to start making documentaries and do a fiction film? Or would you like to stop making documentaries and do a fiction film? That started a series of doing three fiction films for young people. The biggest fan base has Rufus Wainwright when he was 11 years old. So like one of them had a young Rufus Wayne. I don't know which one it was. It's not this one. But isn't that weird? I feel like he's, oh, I made up this story one night for my child, which you can tell. I mean, I feel like it's got that idea of just like, and then this happened.
And then he probably, I was actually thinking that maybe this was made in tandem with the little kid. Because again, to bring up Exquisite Corpse again, it's like, and then you do like the pass off the torch of the story. It's like, then he had a fright, and then a little kid would immediately go, and then you put peanut butter on your head, and then your hair grows back.
Yeah, and you're like, obviously.
Oh, yeah, obviously. That's obviously. Going. Also, it's crunch time, baby. I'm going to type that. The script's due tomorrow.
I know. I mean, I should say that the obvious, I'm sure people are listening who are fans of Houseu or House, the Japanese film, which had similar origins where the director was working with his child and was just like, tell me what makes you afraid in your nightmares, and then wrote a script completely from his child's nightmares. And it is both PG and also terrifying. Mm-hmm. And it's wonderful when you can involve the input of a child.
Yeah.
It turns out.
Yeah. What is that animation that Julia Pott does? So Julia Potts does this. So she's an animator in her own right, but she also collaborated with this other animator who made World of Tomorrow. And it's a conversation between his daughter and Julia Potts and about the future. And it's incredibly, and you can tell that it's like a kid responding off the cuff to these really huge ideas.
Yeah.
And it just gives it this beautiful surrealism, but like sweetness, and in this way that it's like only a kid would like listen to. And then forever we'll be lost in space and no one will remember us. And then the kid will be like, that's sad. Like, it's incredibly, like, cute. It's very sweet, but it's also, like, so heartbreaking.
I mean, that's also the genius behind The Little Prince, for instance, and these kind of sweet but heartbreaking things where you're like, wow. How do you, as an adult, because I find, you know, if you are inundated by media, let's say, I mean, like, you're in a lot of movies and TV shows, you probably watch some, at least like Friends or something, you know, just to stay up on it. But if you're inundated with this, you're reading a lot of scripts, you're writing a lot of scripts, how do you keep yourself from falling into a trap of, I would say, adult thinking of like, here is the logical thing and you can't break that logic?
There's a lot of, like I was saying, in the scenes in Peanut Butter Season that I was rewatching, is allowing that free write and turning off the critic for a very long time. Because there's sometimes, if you write, sometimes I just sit and write, like do scene work with characters and then have them say something that I'm like, this is going to be really absurd, but let's see where it goes.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it ends up being the best part of the scene, which is a new direction that you didn't see coming.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just allowing these characters to talk and allowing yourself to be absurd. But then also a lot of sometimes that stuff gets cut. I was talking about this with Hiro Murai and Donald Glover the other day, and it was like allowing yourself time to fuck up and understanding that writing isn't always plot driven, that it is about playing.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of it. And so when you sit down to write, it's not plot. It's sitting there and being really playful and really allowing yourself to say, what if, you know, and constantly going back to like, what if,
mm-hmm.
and not boxing yourself into, well, logically, she would go and do this thing. Because in addition to the fact that, like, that, you know, you get trapped in that way and it becomes rhythmic and kind of boring.
Yes.
Psychology doesn't really work that way. And people don't make rational decisions. For the most part, we're all walking around motivated by emotions,
mm-hmm.
whether we admit that or not. You know, and it's an irrational, they're irrational responses to things that happen.
Yeah. My life does not follow the formula of a movie because I would have a much straighter path.
Oh, yeah.
I wanted to get into the idea that Roch Demers, when he was making these movies, he was really influenced by the fact that he had, and he said this in a bunch of interviews, that in the early 80s, he was reading a newspaper article and he said suicide among children under 18 had blown up. And he was shocked and didn't understand it. And he said, you know, life is difficult. That's true. Very difficult, but it's so worthwhile. And he wanted to give kids an appetite for life in spite of everything. And so that's, I mean, aside from like the tax incentives, he was kind of in his own way, you know, like the very influenced by this article and, you know, wanted to actually center children. And in a way, I think that works, that I felt, you know, I felt like it was made for me and that no adult had touched it.
Right. And I think that's what one of the other added elements of it is of a good 80s kids movie, too, is that the kids are smarter than the adults,
mm-hmm.
and they're always being underestimated by the adults.
Oh, yeah.
Just even the dad character and even, you know, all of the, and then obviously Signor and then all of these characters that just underestimate the intelligence of the kids sort of sounds like it's part of that. But also, yeah. But also this, how do I explain it without sounding really trippy, but like
do it.
Also redefining for kids like what the horizon line looks like.
Okay.
Of redefining that, like, you think you see the edge of the earth, and you think, like, and your experience right now feels so, you know, that it's your reality, but it's not always going to be reality. So as you start approaching that horizon line, the horizon line changes, and your surroundings change.
Mm-hmm.
So that, like, so that your perception of reality right now is not going to be the way that it is in the future. And I think that that's obviously every couple seconds, the reality of this movie is redefined.
Like, I'm so sorry. What are we doing now?
You know, and I think that plays into whatever psychologically he was trying to do with four kids who feel so stuck and the pain feels so bad.
Yeah.
In, you know, driving them towards suicide. That trying to be like, no, if you keep with it, like, your reality is going to keep changing. And just trust that the horizon line is going to change.
Yeah. And Demmer said, we were telling kids, if one day you're afraid of something, find out why that thing frightens you so much. Most of the time, if you go ahead and find out, you'll realize that there was nothing frightening in it, really, that will help you later on in life to keep growing. And yeah. So I think that plays with the idea of the horizon line, where it's just
exactly.
Like, if you keep going forward, you're actually going to realize that whatever was behind you is not as frightening as it was.
Maybe, right.
You know, there's a next challenge, but you have that information or understanding that you've already surmounted it a lot.
Oh, completely. I mean, and that's it's all character building, right?
Oh, yeah.
You can't say that to a kid, though, when they're, like, in pain and being torn.
No.
And it's character building.
Yeah, it's character building. You're going to be fine. And they're like,
I have. I have no friends. And you're like, it's character building, you know?
Oh, yeah, the good times. That was real great. I mean, do you ever write about kind of parental relationships, or do you explore these things in that way? Are you interested in that?
I am, but I, you know, it's not so directly. Like, I have a script that I wrote about taking care of my dad, because my dad was ill and I took care of him and then he passed away.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have a script, and I started out much like, I'm just going to keep saying, but much like the peanut butter solution, I started actually, like, trying to write a straight script and like, what that process was like.
Yeah.
And it just didn't, for me, just because I like to ride tone so much.
Yeah.
It just didn't emotionally hit the nerve that it feels like to be going through something like that with a parent. So I've, like, since then started to stop thinking about it as, like, my father-daughter relationship and just think, like, trying to meditate more on the way it felt to go through that. I mean,
yeah.
And it's weird. It's hard to describe. I'll try to, but, like, Sun Don't Shine was written when my dad was dying, and that is a movie about denial of death, of me trying to, like, being faced with death all the time, but, like, wanting to bury it in the trunk, in this very literal way, bury it in the trunk so I could just get through the day and deny that it was going to happen. But when you start talking about it to people and say, oh, Sun Don't Shine, Lovers on the Run is about my dad, it sounds really fucked up and strange, you know? But I think in some way, too, you, like, in the girlfriend experience, when we hit the parent, there's an episode where she visits the parents. That was really interesting to me, because it was this trying to, as opposed to making a family drama, presenting how it would feel to be around your parents after it's exposed that you're an escort.
Yeah,
more feeling than it is the direct narrative. elements.
And I mean, we don't talk enough about tone because I think that we don't really know how to talk about it very often. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like you kind of either hit it or not. And it's a poetic aspect of filmmaking, and you know, poetry is also something very difficult to untie. And I'm thinking about that in terms of like Wild Nights with Emily, this mm-hmm. movie that you're in, which has a very peculiar tone.
Yeah.
And it is Madeleine Olnick's movie. And it is, once you get into it, though, you're just like, oh, I'm here. She's established this tone. I'm along for the ride. But I'm wondering, like, when you were reading this script, when you were going through it, did you have an idea? You were like, oh, this is the tone. Or did you have to find it?
There's a lot of finding it. But I've been watching her films for a very long time. So our short, I met her, our shorts, a short I directed, and her short, I believe it was Make Room for Phyllis, played at the Sarasota Film Festival like 2005 or 6, something. That's a long time ago. Wow, that's a long time ago. And and so I had seen that short, and then I had seen several of her other shorts, and then I had also seen Foxy Merkins and Codependence, Lesbian Space Alien.
Yeah, like she, what she makes is like, oh, you know, this is a Madeleine Olnick play film. Or a script or
exactly.
something.
Exactly, and
yeah.
She's a playwright. And so there, and then became a filmmaker. And so I was familiar with it, but there is a lot, because it's such a fine line.
Comedy, drama, melodrama at some points, but not, but mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. poetry,
and
reading.
And also there's a level of... what I love about her stuff is that, you know, my scripts in it are very much written like a play, and we read them like a play, and it's just like tons and tons and tons of like exposition and me talking to the tea ladies and stuff, and you can perform it really perfect, which is what I had prepared to do when I'd come to set, but then what I love about her movies is that there's always this sense that like. Of bewilderment mm-hmm. in the middle of these very well-written chunks. It's like somebody like off in thought and gets confused, and then like it gets not clunky, mm-hmm. but in a way that a period, like specifically in this one, like in a way that a period piece, you never get to see somebody lose their train of thought.
Yeah.
Or get like flustered.
Yeah. It's as though like in period of like, oh, long time ago, we would never lose our train of thought.
Yeah. We have these speeches that just wonderfully come out. And when I'm heartbroken, I say, you know, these beautiful speeches about love and heartbreak. But what she does is that, so you perform it and then you start to play with it. So you perform the lines, but then she starts to play with it and she'll like yell out, say this line, and you're like in the middle of, especially for me, like a 5-page monologue.
Oh, yeah.
And you're just like, wait, no, like mathematically, I know what the next line is. And so she does catch you off guard, but then you say the line, which is scary. You say the line, but then it puts you on another track, and then you perform the lines in this very different way. So it is a lot of playing and trusting her. And trusting that, like, trusting that whatever uncomfortable feeling that you're having when she throws something like that at you is part of her process.
Yeah.
And whatever your body or your face is doing in the moment, that, like, it's probably going to be really funny.
Yeah. I mean, I think it is.
Yeah.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about some of the... I know it's hard to talk about structure with this film, but I do want to talk just a second about structure. We'll be right back.
Welcome.
Thank you.
No problem. Thank
These you. Are real podcast listeners, not actors. What do you look for in a podcast?
Reliability is big for me.
Power.
I'd say comfort.
What do you think of this?
Oh.
That's Jordan Jesse Go.
Jordan Jesse Go?
They came out of the floor?
And down from the ceiling?
That can't be safe.
I'm upset.
Can we go now?
Soon. Jordan Jesse Go, a real podcast.
Welcome
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm joined today by Amy Simons, and we're talking about the peanut butter solution. I got to get into Connie, because Connie is such a fascinating character. I mean, we already talked about the pubic hair that he's got, and like the way, I mean, like, honestly, it scarred so many kids once they realized what, they were like, wait, hold on. This is the scariest part about it. And they just kind of glance over it. There's like that scene where like the hair is just like kind of braided and coming out of his pant legs. And you're like, oh, no.
Yeah, there's like embedded in that scene where they're like, again, I go back to that ghost scene. They bring it up, which I still find one of the more disturbing elements is when they're like, oh, but don't put it on your face or don't get it on your hands because you'll grow hair on your hands, which is obviously a masturbation reference.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is you shouldn't masturbate or else you'll grow hair on your palms.
Yep.
And then also, and nowhere else. And it's like, whenever that happens in little kids' stories, it always makes me feel so uncomfortable. Even as an adult, I'm like, eee. They're making a reference to like their private parts, you know? Yeah. Right? And then, but then.
Do you think this whole thing is a metaphor for masturbation?
I
like it's okay to masturbate.
Yeah,
like,
it's okay to masturbate. Yeah. Like the fright is like he was like, "Whoa, what was that?" Like the first time, and then it was just like, "It's okay.
It's okay. Everything is fine."
Yeah. In the end.
But I am curious about Connie because he's called quote unquote the human flea in this movie by the father, Michael's father. And he's a really courageous character. And I, structure-wise, what happens is Michael disappears from the movie for a little while. And then we are with Connie and Susie. We don't see where Michael is. And it's a weird thing for us to go from the main character completely disappearing. We're not checking in with him whatsoever. We're all of a sudden with the secondary characters, and they're leading this. And Connie is the one that saves the day.
Yeah.
I find that fascinating.
Yeah. It's still, again, it's like this, it's a stream of consciousness. It's like, let's pick up here and go this way.
Yeah.
And then, but yeah, no, I mean, I was trying to figure out the structure. The other thing that I find so fascinating, not just with the structure, but is the use of characters. Like every character you're introduced to comes back in this elliptical way. Like the doctor turns out to be Senor's brother, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And there's just like this weird elliptical element coming around. It's like the only sort of it's the only sort of mathematical thing happening in the movie.
Sure, yeah.
But even with Connie and the sister, it's like that's the closest thing to what the 80s were doing with movies anyway. Like with the friends, like the kid friends that are...
Mm-hmm.
They're kind of the only ones you can trust in the movie.
Yeah.
Like as a kid, it's like, as long as I have friends like that, then I'm going to be okay.
Yes.
Which is a great, I think a really good message for like the kids, like going back to what his message was for the kids too, is like adults can be so awful and they're trying to tell you what reality is. And like if you have your friend that believes you and stands by your side like Connie does.
Yeah.
It's a really beautiful thing.
We could also relate this a little bit to Pet Sematary, I would say. Yeah, like the.
I want to hear that. I'm trying to think of the
parents
house.
Are not to be trusted. I think
no, yeah, and there's also like you know, then there's also the seduction of like the place in the woods, and then that house that you go into,
yeah,
and catching the fright, or
yeah,
you know. People come back not the same, you know?
It's true. Yeah. Oh, my God.
We did it. I can spin anything.
Oh, see? There it is. There it is. I mean, I feel like before we... I want to talk about, like, my favorite scenes. There's something about, you know, like, returning to the tone. This had kind of an almost after-school special look to it. You know, there was the kind of lighting and cinematography made it feel almost... realer, which gave it such a peculiar thing, like the putting these tones, the friction of a tone of an after school special that would deal with real things on a fantasy movie is strange. I'm curious. I mean, like in the way that you approach things, I love things with tonal friction.
Yeah.
And the way that like maybe the execution is so much you know, stranger than what might be on the page, you know, or vice versa. Do you ever think about that when you're kind of when you're going to production, you know, like how you can kind of fuck things up in that way?
Yeah. Or the opposite, mm-hmm. where you write something and then there's constantly a tension of that. It's like you can always write. There's always a tension between sometimes on the page you write something that you're like, this is. They're making a really insane decision, mm-hmm. and this seems like a really insane set piece or something. And so in the execution on set, I like to find the way to ground it.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other thing is the other tension is something that's so simple, like a really something that on the page seems like a decision that is so simple but means so much, is like then really amping that up when you're executing it, mm-hmm. in the way that you sort of over amplify something that seems like a simple moment. So there's a constant friction of that, which are all trying to you're trying to calibrate to the same level or the tone that exists in the same world.
Well, I'm curious in terms of like Pet Sematary and as a performer doing this, horror is a really strange thing because sometimes you can't be too samey because otherwise it doesn't feel scary. So you almost have to play it the other way. So I was wondering if you could even like share some kind of thing maybe from set where you had to kind of recalibrate.
Yeah, I mean, I think in any horror performance, you're or at least the way that I like doing it for myself is towing that line of the pulpiness and mm-hmm. towing the line of genre acting, which is like is way more heightened,
yeah,
and way more—I don't want to say cartoonish, just extremely animated in the face. And
like I always feel like you can go all the way up to Isabella Gianni in Possession. You mm-hmm. know, like that's your ceiling. So like it's available to you.
You can get there, but you have to. In order to get there, like even watching her performance in that movie, in order to allow her to get to that place, even that first scene in Possession with her and what's his name,
Sam Neill
in the bed when they're talking about affairs.
Yeah.
Is even they're already at like she's at 100. If she's at 100 in that performance, they're already at about a 50-60.
You know
what I mean? Like that, it's not a, it's real. It is shot realism, but their performances are just off.
Yeah,
enough for when we watch her get possessed and do that magnificent experimental dance in the tunnel, and then also enough for us to accept that she's having an affair with a beast, you know, and the beast wants to like fuck everyone. Like you have to like you have to know where you need to be to, you know, like you've got to know. You can't start you keep, that movie doesn't work if you start from just like a normal
like
couple.
A 10 to 0 kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly.
You've
got to
be okay.
So like knowing where you're about to take it or what believability we need to get to. You can't go from 0 to 100 in a movie. You have to be like we start at this level of
there's just not
melodrama or whatever. Yeah.
Yes.
And so you're constantly battling grounding a performance and then also remembering where you need to go.
Yeah.
Because you'll lose the audience tonally if you just suddenly make this leap into horror acting.
Yeah.
So it's constantly just calibrating where we're at and then also I mean because I'm a filmmaker too, I also rely a lot on the guys like Dennis and Kevin in performance is like what's the sound design that's happening here. Like how?
So you can ask them, you know, like what are you feeling for the sound? Like what is this?
What are you cutting to? Where's the like, you know, so that not
which is different because you're a filmmaker too, so you can see it from both sides of that.
Yeah, and it helps me just because it helps me not because I'm trying to get away with not performing, but like it helps me to know that like I'm supported by this sound design, and then the next shot is it, like when we open this. This is what the special effect is, and you know, so that I can understand how to react to things in the room that aren't necessarily there.
Yeah,
and also not overdo it and not feel like it's all on my shoulders.
Yeah. This is like the exact opposite, I would say, of like how Kubrick was like approaching The Shining, where he's just like, I'm not going to tell you guys anything.
Yeah.
I'm just going to throw these actors in here and destroy you mentally.
Yeah.
As opposed to just like trusting an actor can kind of get there if you give them the information.
Yeah, I wonder if he and I would fight. Like, I think we would have fought. I think we would have fought. Definitely, because I would have wanted to know those things. But then at the end of the day, too, when I go on the sets, you can ask all the questions you want, but you also just have to do it.
Yeah.
In order to know where, like, if it's wrong or not.
Yeah.
You know?
I really feel like when we talk about performance, we really need to talk about Matthew McKay's performance in this movie as Michael, though, because you're talking about selling something believability by starting an actor or performance rather at a certain level so it can reach what it needs to get to. And there is something certainly off about him and his character pretty immediately in this film. And so when he's like angrily drumming, you know, drumming. He's like, and he's like got the bald cap on and it's just like, oh, like, this is beautiful. Like, they were like, go for it, Matthew.
Yeah.
And he took it. And then there's also that moment where he's wearing this wig that's trailing him. And it's windy. And he's, like, leaving the house. And he's like, I'm going to school.
In protest.
And it is so surreal. But he's so committed to it that I'm like, as a child actor, like, you're entering this world, like, you know, you nailed it. Like, you made me believe that this world is, you know,
really happening.
Yeah. It's very surreal.
Yeah. And that the pain of getting made fun of going, like, not wanting to go to school at first because you're bald, and then, like,
yeah.
And the pain of getting made fun of and just wanting to be a normal kid. I mean, he did such a good job. That drumming scene is really noteworthy.
Before we go, I need to know, like, what your favorite kind of gif-worthy moments are from this film.
There's definitely when he goes into the house and to the scary house and he sees the thing and his hair just stands up straight. Yeah.
And we get, like, it's a backlit shot, I think.
Yeah,
so it's almost
very
like
an eraser head.
Yeah, exactly. It is. It's so, yeah, exactly.
So that's definitely one. That's a good one to send to somebody if something bad happened to them.
Yeah.
Just to cheer them up. Like, I just saw my ex-boyfriend or
We didn't even get to the fact that this is like Celine Dion's breakthrough as well. Lyrics to the song that she sang for the soundtrack. I'll just read those. Listen to the magic man. Got a trick that's so slick. Disappears just as quick as a lick. Listen to the magic man. A bing bong, a ping pong. And you are off to Hong Kong.
Listen to the magic man. And abracadabra, your life's in Cinerama.
Those are the lyrics. And that's young Celine Dion's breakthrough.
Talk about tone. She got it.
She understood. Okay, all right. We have to go, but I could talk about this movie for hours. Thank you so much for selecting it. No one else would.
Somebody had to.
The bravery of Amy Symetz. Okay, and so people will be able to see in theaters Wild Nights with Emily and Pet Sematary. Mm-hmm. And VOD were in May?
I don't know. They pushed it, so I'm not sure on the exact date.
So y'all need to look it up. But I think everyone should just go and see My Days of Mercy at their home, at their own convenience, and then go to the theater, and you can see Wild Nights with Emily and Pet Sematary.
Yes.
And probably VOD eventually, because that's where everything ends up anyway.
Yep.
Okay, thank you so much for joining us today. And
thank you.
Thanks, everyone, for hanging with us. Thank you for listening to Switchblade Sisters. If you like what you're hearing, please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. If you do, we'll read it on air. If you want to let us know what you think of the show, you can tweet at us at SwitchbladePod or email us at SwitchbladeSisters@MaximumFun.org. Please check out our Facebook group. That's Facebook.com/groups/SwitchbladeSisters. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. And this is a production of MaximumFun.org.
You dare to imagine in my class.
MaximumFun.org.
comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.